Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the thicket of views in modern Buddhism and the difficulties that often follow from adapting the Buddha's direct teachings to fit conditioned views. This talk was recorded on March 7, 2017. A video of this class is available on my video archive page and on my YouTube channel. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace.
So, how many of you have read this week's article? 3, 4. Okay. Well, I'm not going to read the article, so I'm glad some of you did, but it's on there. It's a rather long article. I think a little over 3,000 words. And not everything in the article is relevant to our Sangha here. It's more relevant to, well, the title of the article is Modern Buddhism, A Thicket of Views. And so it's really in that context. And I know I talk about that often here, the different contradictions, especially when there's a modern convention that really contradicts what I might be teaching or what's included in the sutta. I always point that out. And this article has probably been, I've probably been writing it in the back of my head since I first became exposed to any type of Buddhism. And practically, I started writing it about 6 months ago in relation to some questions that were coming up, sometimes in here, but usually in the past, but also from many online students. And then a few things happened recently that, I just kind of felt it was time to get it all out there, so I did. I don't mean to be controversial ever, but sometimes I find myself upsetting some people, and that's never my intention, and certainly not in this article. But getting back to the title, there's certainly a thicket of views in modern Buddhism. There's a lot of different contradictory teachings, lineages, schools, traditions, all claiming authenticity, and most of them claiming authenticity all the way back to the Buddha's direct teachings. That phrase, a thicket of views, is something the Buddha used often. And in particular, there's a sutta, I know I mentioned Vajragoda here often. I think the first time, at least the first time I came across that term, a thicket of views, in the Pali Canon was in a sutta called the Agi Vajragoda Sutta. So Vajragoda was this wanderer who kept coming in and out of the Buddha's life, basically asking the same questions. And those questions were all seeking answers to very confused views and answers that had no relation to developing understanding as the Buddha taught understanding, and meaning developing the Four Noble Truths. So Vajragoda would ask questions such as, is the universe finite or infinite? One of his favorite questions that he probably asked us every time he came across the Buddha is, what happens to the Buddha after death? Is the Buddha alive? Does the Buddha continue after death, or does the Buddha end at death? He wanted to know about the nature of the self and the soul. Does the soul continue forever, or is the soul finite? Which is, if you look at all those questions, they're all basically the same question, which is, what happens to me in the future? Meaning it's continued eye-making. And the Buddha would either just remain silent as a way of showing Vajragoda or anybody else with these questions that the questions themselves don't even deserve an answer because they're rooted in foolishness. Or he would reply that your questions themselves are the problem. They're creating a thicket of views in your mind. Take to the Dhamma, meaning develop the Eightfold Path, create an understanding of the Four Noble Truths, and those answers will be seen as unimportant. You'll see stop seeking the questions, rather than getting stuck into this recurring and recursive thicket of views. A lot of modern Buddhism has its foundation in something, in a sect called the Mahasanghikas, which were a sect within the Buddhist Sangha, but this is about 400 years after the Buddha's passing. And the Mahasanghikas wanted a more visionary and more mystical type of Buddhism to practice. They also wanted to elevate the Buddha, who was still at that time seen realistically as a human being, and they wanted to elevate the Buddha to have the status of a god and to be one of many gods that extended back infinitely into the past and infinitely into the future, and make that basically their practice. Those monks and nuns that were still practicing what the Buddha taught resisted this, and there were some other things. They wanted to make some changes into the Vinaya, the rules of the order. They resisted. The Mahasanghika split off and started practicing their own form of Buddhism. And you can trace loosely modern Mahayana Buddhism back to that original Protestant form of Buddhism. Again, that doesn't delegitimize what has followed. They millions and millions of followers over thousands of years. They're established schools or religions. You know, that's the way it is. But from that initial break, now anything that could be introduced often was introduced and became a teaching of the Buddha simply because it was founded in that. So modern Buddhism has developed their own type of thicket of views. It's very difficult, I would say impossible, because I've been involved in this a long time, trying to make sense and to reconcile one particular modern school with the other. There's some schools that believe in simply chanting. If you chant enough and often, and if this chant is on your lips when you die, you're going to be taken to a type of Buddhist heaven. That may be true, but it never made a lot of sense to me, and it was not something that the Buddha taught. Contrast that with another school that basically says that there's some moral and ethical guidelines we should be aware of, but it is in mostly an intense singular meditation practice that often discounts the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. Then there's other schools that have very elaborate rituals and visualizations. The school that I took my vows in many years ago teaches that a preliminary practice is 108,000 full prostrations, meaning from a standing position, you lay down, you touch your head on the floor, you stand up. That's one. You do that 108,000 times, and then you can really begin your practice in earnest. And that's usually taught as part of a 3-year retreat. Again, that's an established religion. That's fine. When I started realizing that this is not likely something that the Buddha taught, it's when I started looking at what he actually taught. And I realized then, when I looked at the written record, that the Buddha taught something that had very little to do with rituals or practices or anything that really had to be taken on faith. He taught something that was direct and very simple and that any human being could develop themselves. In other words, there was no outside force or outside power that had to bestow any special kind of privilege or understanding on you. This was an inside job that any human being could do. And that changed everything for me. So you contrast that with what's there in modern Buddhism, and you have some difficulties in that. In the last, going back probably 75 years, approximately, when Buddhism was first really introduced to the West, and it goes back a little further than that, but in earnest, about 75 or 80 years ago with a few teachers. From that time to this day, there's now been this push to reconcile all the different Buddhist teachings into one Western type of Buddhism. And this is what I get into in the article a little bit, and it's what I've noticed, that it's in that need to reconcile and find a one-size-fit-all Western type of Buddhism that the Buddha's direct teachings are almost completely ignored. They're diminished in importance greatly, or they're completely ignored. Some schools will mention the Four Noble Truths and treat it as an archaic practice and really something that, okay, you know, read it, get to know what it says, and then do this practice. And you get indoctrinated in other practices. And again, either the Four Noble Truths are diminished or they're completely ignored. And the problem with that, on that point of conscious ignorance, then everything that the Buddha taught is lost. And what follows from that, according to dependent origination, can only be rooted in ignorance of the... Again, I'm not saying that people that practice other ways are ignorant, but they certainly, if you don't develop an understanding of the Four Noble Truths, you're certainly ignorant of it, just like we all are. You know, you can't... Most people can't magically learn something just by hearing about it. You have to actually study something, right? That's all I'm saying. The Buddha awakened to something that called dependent origination, and it's probably his most important teaching in a general way, and the one teaching that is completely misapplied by almost all of the modern schools. Again, that's fine. But when you understand why that's done, you can see how clearly that Buddha's admonition that it is ignorance of Four Noble Truths that all manners of confusion, delusion, and suffering arises. Because it's in that need to reconcile all Buddhism into one type of Western teaching that the original teachings are ignored. And so no matter how all-inclusive, no matter how comforting, no matter how insightful, they're lacking in that key understanding. And what I get into in the article, and it's a little bit of a distasteful subject, and I don't mean to get anybody riled up, but it just needs to be said. And I'm really saying that because I wanted to have it on the record. Over time, there's been too many scandals of teachers abusing their power and their students in a very direct way that has proven to be incredibly hurtful to those students, and I think in a general way, very hurtful to Buddhism. There's people that still will say, oh, I don't want anything to do with that crazy stuff. Look at what's happened. And of course, these are very few isolated teachers, but there's also, you know, that few is rather large in number. Almost to a person, these teachers claim to have the one true Buddhism, which is something that happened during the Buddha's time too. That's why the talk on the to the Kalamas was first presented, and I'll mention that in a moment. And many of them said that what they're teaching is this kind of unified Buddhist theory. I'm teaching something that brings all the Buddhist traditions into one. This is what I teach. And not every Mahayana teacher, certainly it's a very small percentage that ended up being hurtful or abusive in some way. But again, many of them did. And I cannot believe that that would have happened if they had actually developed the Buddhist teaching. And often these teachers' followers excuse their behavior or continue ignorance of it, meaning they just ignore it. They don't want to face it at all. And to me, that's just as damaging. If you don't acknowledge what's occurred, there's no way that it's not going to continue. And often these teachers are given license to act that way because they're said, well, they're so advanced that it's okay that they do these things. They're beyond human failings. Does that make any sense? No, it doesn't. And it's just a hurtful thing, and it's a hurtful excuse. So excuse the rant. That's one of the problems that follows. So I mentioned in this article, and I cite it a few different ways, the Kalama Sutta and the Ratana Sutta. The Kalama Sutta was a sutta that the Buddha gave, and I mentioned this just last week, I think, to a group called the Kalamas who were very confused about what practice should they follow. They lived on a trade route, so all the major spiritual teachers of that time passed through there. Everyone gave their teaching, and they said, I'm the one true teacher, you should follow me. And a day later, somebody else would come through and say the same thing. They had happened to hear of the Buddha. They called the Buddha in, said, you know, this is what happens. How do we know? How do we choose? So I'll just read the Buddha's words because they relate directly to what I'm saying. The Buddha said, do not go by others' accounts or by legends or traditions. Do not follow scriptures, meaning later developed texts, or logical conjecture, meaning conditioned thinking. Do not form conclusions through inference, analogies, or common agreement, meaning who all you're associating with. He taught that the only way to experience the effectiveness of his Dhamma was to develop the Dhamma as he taught it. In other words, when he concluded this, then he instructed the Kalamas on the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. And then he said, if you want to develop this understanding, you can't merely listen to me, you have to actually develop it yourself. And then you'll know from your own experience whether it works. And then he gives some clues as to that. Does it lead to cessation of confused and deluded thinking? Does it lead to the cessation of the defilements of greed, aversion, and continued deluded thinking? If it does, then you know you have something useful. If it doesn't, discard it. But then he also said, and this is another thing that has given license over the years to creating any type of Buddhism that the individual or a group may want, is that people insist that in this sutta, the Buddha said, we should question everything. And that's not what he said. He said, you should develop an understanding and then relate it to what I teach and then decide for yourself. And then he also said, and he said this in many other suttas, that if you're confused about what I teach, you don't understand how to apply it, question me directly. He never said, and think about this, would it make sense? He taught something for 45 years and then would say, if you question it, forget it, it's meaningless. Of course, that'd be ridiculous. It would have been a waste of a human life, and it certainly wasn't. He said, question me directly. Now, we certainly can't do that anymore, can we? He's not here in front of us. But what we can do is we can still look to the written record. The Pali Canon is an authentic record of the Buddha's teachings. Or you can find someone, you know, you're very fortunate to have me. You can find, and I'm, of course I mean that somewhat jokingly, I'm fortunate to have all of you more than you're fortunate to have me. But the point I'm making, if you're going to follow something and you want to call it Buddhism, at least find out if your teacher has actually developed the Buddha's Dhamma. If not, and you want to follow that, what the Buddha taught, then you need to find a teacher. If you're comfortable in finding benefit in something else, that's fine too. I have no argument with that. But again, getting back to the underlying problem, look at the problems that have occurred because of that. I can't imagine a teacher that could do some of the things that have happened over the years if they had actually developed the Buddha's Dhamma. Can you imagine the Buddha giving a talk drunk? One of the most famous Buddhist teachers, he's now passed, did that. And it was even talked about by his students how marvelous it was that he could give such great teachings while he was drunk. To me, that's just so disgraceful to what the Buddha taught. And again, I don't mean to single out any single person. There's so many other abuses that that teachers, deluded thinking teachers, led to. And if they had only developed the Dhamma, that couldn't possibly have happened. The other sutta that I mentioned is the Ratana Sutta. In the Ratana Sutta, the Buddha, you know, we talked about this just last week, the Ratana Sutta was given to a group that was devastated by famine and floods. The Buddha attended to their needs, and then he explained to them, if you want to find true refuge from the suffering that is inherent in the world, from the dukkha that occurs, the refuge is in taking refuge in the Buddha and understanding that it is a human being that awakened, and because a human being has awakened, you can do the same. Take refuge in his Dhamma, because there's a true refuge in that. It leads you to a place of understanding dukkha and ending the defilements of greed, aversion, and deluded thinking. The Eightfold Path does that. And then he finally said, to take refuge in a well-focused Sangha. In fact, he said there is no more important jewel than a well-focused Sangha. Think about how that relates to the thicket of views. A well-focused Sangha, not something that is striving to incorporate everything that's out there into one kind of unified New Age Buddhism. It's just hurtful. It just is. And that, you know, that's from my direct experience. I'm so fortunate, and in the last few years, I've been able to talk to a lot of people all over the world. Not that there's thousands, but there's a good handful. And this subject keeps coming up, and I keep hearing from people that were. This is kind of what led me to finally finish this article. That were just devastated by what's happened. Can you imagine giving your trust completely to something, and you feel that it is based on just pure compassion? And all you find is abuse. It's just so hurtful. So again, excuse the little bit of a rant, and I just felt it was neat to kind of talk about this. If you're interested in the article, it's online, and you can read it. And so I think that's enough for the talk tonight. I hope I've made nobody uncomfortable. So let's go around the room. I'd like to hear how your practice is. I'd like to hear how last week's talk on the Ratana Sutta, if you found benefit and how you see how that fits into this, and if you have any comments on what I just said tonight. So we'll start with Stefan. It's good to see you tonight.
Good to see you too. I don't know, I kept trying to reflect on the Ratana Sutta during the week, and I never really felt like I made any exciting connections, but I am grateful for the Sangha, and I'm grateful for your teaching and steadfastness, and grateful for the Dharma. So, there is that. My practice. practice is going okay. I don't know.
Great. Thank you. Ram, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you. I'm glad you wrote the article because even though I don't have real direct experience with other Buddhist movements, still my own background contains a lot of it. Mm-hmm. And even though it was kind of fascinating, I kind of started out being fascinated with Zen because it was nice and rebellious. Mm-hmm. And wild. And but it never led me to actual understanding or an end of my confusion and suffering. But I'm just so glad that I found this here, where, and it's been a slow process. It's been almost 2 years of, basically sanding off all the veneer of what I've accumulated over the decades to finally come to something where I can keep going back to the same principles and keep applying them. And every time I apply the principles in my life, there is an actual lessening of suffering and confusion. It's a working system.
Yeah.
And I'm just glad that it's here. And I'm very slowly getting to the point where I can start bringing that out to, when I see people that are, stuck in their little thicket of views and stuck in their suffering and don't understand where it's coming from, that I can actually tell them something.
Yeah.
This is, you can try this. It looks like it's a good thing.
Yeah.
Thank you
for saying that. The 2 years is pretty quick compared to what a lot of the way it's always been presented to me was that it takes endless lifetimes to develop this understanding. And that never made sense. I said, it doesn't sound like a Buddha would teach, an awakened human being would teach something that you can't really do. And he didn't.
But most of what's in the way of the understanding is
the thicket of views.
The thicket of views.
And insisting that those answers be included or be a focus of whatever the teaching is. That's really part of the problem, too.
Mm.
And the other thing is, you mentioned the influence that you had over the years. The students that I've had that had the greatest difficulty are the ones that had been practicing Buddhist for many years. And almost to a person, they said, it's surprising how many said that, I've been doing this certain practice for 20, 30 years, and nobody's ever mentioned the Four Noble Truths. But that's common. I mean, that was true for me too. And again, it's a different practice when you don't. That continues the ignorance that the Buddha awakened to, ignorance of Four Noble Truths.
I remember saying to people, in the very beginning, I was just coming here because I didn't want a place to sit. With some people. And I remember saying to some people that I'm just going out to sit. I don't care what this guy's talking about. and that went on for months.
But eventually,
yeah. It started seeping into my thick skull that this could actually work.
Yeah.
And I spend a lot of time questioning, questioning you, looking at the Dharma in print, and things just started falling together.
But you were questioning in context, and that's a big difference than
yes.
questioning to find where it's wrong. You were just questioning, how does it fit? You know, that's a big difference, you know, and a significant difference. So.
Yeah, because I had questions about it, because it didn't fit with what I had learned before.
Yeah.
And so I would go in there and think, well, is this bullshit or is this not bullshit? And, you know, it does fit. Okay, good. We can keep that.
Yeah.
Next.
I never said this to your face, but I used to think, this is Vachagoda.
It really, there came a point where Vachagoda even got it as well, right?
I never across that.
Okay.
It's such an interesting thing to follow through the Pali Canon, because there's different suttas on Vachagoda. The Agi Vachagoda is the first one, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But he comes in the same questions, and you can just kind of see the Buddha in his great patience, listening and saying the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
He offers it, Vachi, it's your questions that are confusing you. Let go of the questions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, put it in this right context. But, thank you, Judy. Good to see you tonight.
Good to be here.
Yeah, it's nice to have you back.
My practice is going pretty well. I mean, it's been ongoing pretty much, even though I haven't made it to the Sangha. So I'm happy for that, because it does help my perspective on things that are going on in my life.
Yeah.
So and I'm very grateful for that. And I'm very grateful also that I don't have any history.
Yeah.
I don't have any
should be.
teachers of Buddhism except for you. And so for that, I'm very grateful. So, and I wasn't here last week, so I don't know what happened.
we were finishing the Truth of Happiness course last week, and it's just the talk on the Ratana Sutta, the Sutta on taking refuge.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Nothing terribly profound.
Oh, yeah. But anyway, I don't have anything else.
Oh, good. It's good to see you.
Thank
you. Andrew, how are you tonight? Mm-hmm. Good to see you.
Yeah. Well, of late my practice has been erratic, so I'm afraid I don't have any insights tonight.
Oh.
I think I'll pass.
I'm glad you're here, Andrew. Helen, good to see you. How are you?
Thank you, John. It's good to be here. I've missed the last 3 or 4 classes, but I have been able to add that second meditation at night, so that's been good. And I managed to sign up for the retreat.
Yes!
So that's my progress right there.
That's great progress.
So, and I picked up another Thich Nhat Hanh book, so I was reading that. And so I'm still, working my way through it. I just remind myself it's all that simple and it's all that hard. I just keep plugging away at it.
Good. Do you notice any benefit yet from the second sit?
I think just a more sense of calm.
Yeah.
So that's nice.
Yeah, that is.
Yeah.
Thank you. Good to see you tonight.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Keith, how are you tonight? Good to see you.
Good to see you. Good to be here. I've done actually the opposite. The past 4 or 5 days, I have not had my second sit. And I absolutely noticed a difference. Much less focused and concentrated. So I just need to get back to where I need to be and keep doing it. But that's really all I have, except for I also have no other knowledge of any Buddhist teachings. So reading your article is very insightful. I didn't know that there were so many conflicted views and teachings, and it's just happy that I stumbled in here and not someone else.
Thank you. It's good to see you, Keith. Bonnie, how are you tonight?
I'm good, thanks. I related to when Ram said that he just came to sit. That was like, that's why I'm just going to come to. I want to develop a meditation practice, and I want to have another belief system. I'm trying to figure out, sort of like maybe when you are quiet, what's inside, but ended up that, you know, I think all along the beliefs that you shared with us, that somehow they've been intrinsic to how I, maybe not how I treated myself, but how I treated others. So, and so in being present, so it's also affected how I treat myself, with which then affects how I treat others.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really a really neat thing to be able to still keep growing and learning, you know, and feeling like that it's just about being in the river and rowing. So that there's that. And then being able to, I don't sit twice a day, but just the fact that I sit at least once a day now is for at least 20 minutes. Sometimes it's a half hour, but I was telling Ron too that whereas here we have the callbacks, but at home we don't. And at first it was really hard. It was like, what? Oh, what is it ending? I need those markers like to help me. And I think I told you, the more I sit, the harder I was being, you know, I was like feeling really distracted, but then just being aware of all the distractions we have in our lives, in my life, in my head. But it's just really recently, now this, maybe even as recent as this week, that I've settled into that, into not needing the callback, and that, and despite not wanting to sit or feeling like I have so much I need to do, that it's all, now I'm feeling like really hungry, like I want that space to do nothing but breathe. And so that's refuge. You know, it's just like a break, which was where I was when I first started, although I didn't know really what it was really all about in some ways, although I sort of.
Thank you for that. That really is a significant development when we start seeing our meditation practice as it really is, as a true refuge. Because it is, even if it, you know, just that, even if it's just 5 minutes, just to withdraw ourselves, you know, and calm our senses and just be present with what's occurring. What a great gift. And then we have the broader framework of the Eightfold Path in which to practice that.
Which, you know, the Eightfold Path to me is like, it's really hard for me to believe that it's that old. I mean, I don't know why, but...
Well, that it survived all this time. That's the remarkable thing.
But, and there's so many references in modern psychology. Really, that's where the, you know, the, I think a lot of, well, you know, a lot of cognitive thinking of it, it's taken right from there, because...
In a way, yes.
I think very specifically. But one other thing I wanted to say about what you're talking about, having teachers and then people put their trust in their teachers and they idolize their teachers and then they believe that whatever the teacher does is necessary or, you know, allowable. And I see that it's not just in Buddhism. It's,
oh, no.
It's in anywhere where people come sort of feeling vulnerable and wanting to trust in the goodness or that of what people offer. And, you know, so and then the last thing, I had shared it with Ron before too, but the title of your article reminds me of a Talmudic phrase. And I don't know exactly the exact reference, but it goes something like, what does a clever man do? He cuts through a thicket of reeds, and in doing so, creates a path for others to follow.
Wow.
So, in a way, you know, that's really what a good teacher does, I think.
Yeah, and that's what the Eightfold Path does, too. Mm-hmm. You know, that's why it's so...
Thank you.
That's why it's so hurtful to ignore it. Let me go on to Frank. I was thinking about maybe I'll finish with that. Frank, it's good to see you tonight.
It's good to be here. Good to see everybody. I'm just getting back to the Sangha. I think recently for me, I like what everyone had to say tonight. You said everything I wanted to say, so I've shared this before. I work in a really chaotic environment, and some things that have been happening for me. I'm really steady with my meditation practice, 2 times a day. I'm starting to see a need for a 3rd time a day at lunch. And it's not that I'm distracted. I think that I'm really aware of how distracted everybody else is. And when I'm around 30 people constantly of distraction, my head spins a little bit.
Yeah.
And I do take refuge in meditation and the Dhamma. And I feel like I need to be drawn more towards like-minded people, because I'm starting to feel that people don't understand why I'm so calm. But although it doesn't, I might look calm and be acting calm, but in my mind, when I'm around all that chaos, I just need to get away from it. I start to feel sick.
It's hard.
And I just wanted to say that. And as far as your article, I didn't read it yet. I will, but I just think that it's not, isolated to the Buddhism thing. Like you were saying, it's all over. In the religion that I was raised in, it was a lot of sick people out there, and you need to be careful who you trust. And I come here because it's simplistic, and I like that. And I'm grateful that I found it. I stumbled in also, and thankful that I didn't. I looked at Buddhism a year or two ago, and it was too confusing to me. I was like, and I wasn't interested in another religion, another belief system. And when I talked to you on our first conversation, you told me that it was never intended to be that. I was here. That's all I needed to hear. Anyway, thanks.
Thank you, Frank. I'm glad you're here. Lorna, good to see you. How are you?
Very well, thank you. My history is that I've never really been inclined to follow any religion or belief system because I've never believed in them. They just don't ring a bell with me. They don't do anything for me at all. They never have. Obviously, I've spoken to people and they've sort of tried to tell me about what they believe in and this and that, and I just couldn't get into it at all. Didn't even want to try. For some reason, it's just not in me. I stumbled into your class because I too wanted to learn a meditation technique, and I had no idea what the Four Noble Truths was, and so that came as a bit of a surprise, but as I say, I listened, and everything sort of made sense, and so I keep on coming, and I keep on coming, and I'd like to think that I vote with my feet what I believe in, and who I believe, where I want to believe it. I come here regularly, and I'd like to think that that's my position, that I come here. I don't go anywhere else, I come here. So that's kind of all I can say about that, really. As far as my practice, I just think the closing of the whole book review and the closing of the book review that we had last week, I think it's been the most fantastic consecutive 10 weeks of thought about the Dharma. I think it's been a wonderful book review. I really do. From week to week, my mind is like jumping from this to that to that to that. Things I hadn't, and it was just so energizing to me, mentally energizing. I just thought it was wonderful. I just thought it was great. Didn't want it to end, but obviously it did do. Anyway, probably from that, I sort of realized a lot of things about myself, I think, from the book review. And this week, I kind of found myself reflecting that I really could feel the... I can't remember how you say it, the underlying stress of life. I think in the past I've known individual pockets of stress, and that's where this, and I've looked at the individual pockets of stress, and okay, you know, this is stressful, that's stressful, blah, blah, blah. I don't think I've really felt that there is an underlying, an overarching underlying theme of stress that runs through my life. I've always looked at, as I said, the stress points. So I'm beginning to appreciate that there is stress in our lives, not necessarily coming from one point to another point to another point, but there is an underlying stress to my life. And I haven't seen it that way before. I've always looked at, as I say, different things that's going on in your life at the time, that week, that month, or that time, that day. That's a stress point. But I say I can feel that it's a greater appreciation of it I think I have now.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I think that's from the book review as well. I think the book review was just phenomenal.
Thank you. That what you're describing is, as right view continues to develop, we can no longer ignore what is right in front of us. That underlying stress, dukkha, occurs. Just, it's a consequence of living in the world. We can't escape it. And that ignorance points back to dependent origination. Again, developing right view is developing. When the Buddha described right view, the first thing he said is that view understands profoundly the nature of stress. We can no longer ignore it. And that is kind of what we've been talking about. Bonnie mentioned it too. The these types of very hurtful behavior is just part of humanity. You know, there's always been hurtful people in the world, and many of them believe that they were right in some way, no matter how egregious their behavior was. That's an aspect of deluded thinking. You know, confused and deluded thinking, part of dukkha. It can't be excused, but the problem is not that we excuse it. The problem is that we want to ignore those types of things. We don't want to face the fact that we can have Buddhist teachers that prey on young boys, or we can have Catholic priests that prey on young boys, or all the rest of it. People don't even want to talk about it. I think I'm probably making some of you uncomfortable even bringing this up and talking about this subject. But it's just the truth. It happens because we don't understand who we are. We couldn't act that way towards other human beings if we understood who we are in relation to the world. Another way of saying that, if we understood our own suffering, we could no longer instill suffering on others. It's just not possible. And again, that's what the Buddha taught. And again, just to kind of put the cap on this whole thing tonight, there's another sutta called the Saddhamma Sutta. I'm not sure if that's the right... I got a lot of sutras floating around in my head, but I'm going to give the talk this Saturday. And in that talk, this is much later on in the Buddha's career, probably pretty close to the end, you know, maybe 42 or 43 years in. And the Buddha's addressing a question by Mahakasapa, was one of the senior monks. In fact, he was often called the father of the Sangha. He really guided so many other younger monks and nuns along the way over the years. So Mahakasapa asked the Buddha, why do we have more rules in the Sangha than we used to have? Why do you keep adding more rules to it? And the Buddha said, as the Dhamma gets diluted. Now think about this. Even in the Buddha's time, there was a tendency to want to manipulate and adapt the Buddha to fit different views. As the Dhamma becomes diluted in our within our Sangha, within the Buddha Sangha, better not happen here, within the Buddha Sangha, behavior falls apart. We need, that the last was not the Buddha's words, but we need more rules because behavior, there's no containing poor behavior anymore. So even within the Sangha, and isn't that exactly what has happened 2,600 years later? By ignoring what the Buddha was teaching, behavior goes to hell. That's what occurs. And it doesn't go to hell when we use the framework of the Eightfold Path to monitor our self-referential views and our self-referential actions. It just can't. It's not possible. You know? So those the same teachings that the Buddha gave 2,600 years ago, this is another thing that I touched on in the article because it often comes up that, well, if the Buddha was alive today, he would certainly change his teachings to fit the modern times. Well, the problem is still the same. The problem of suffering and the three defilements of greed, aversion, and deluded thinking are still exactly the same. They're still the common human problem. And we keep coming up with different systems and different political ideas and all these other ways of solving the problem. And some of them are helpful. Some of them help to keep the lid on things. But we're never going to solve the common problem of one human hurting another, whether it's inadvertently or directly, until we all wake up, until we develop the Four Noble Truths, those same teachings that were here 2,600 years ago. It really is the key to saving ourselves, and the key to all of that, the key to the whole Buddhist teaching, is dependent origination. And simply, you don't have to memorize it, but simply recognize it. It's ignorance of the Four Noble Truths that leads to my suffering and everybody else's. So let's do our best to take to the Dhamma and awaken. If we want to. Nobody has to. Again, so that's the end of the talk today. But I'll ask once more, any questions or comments? As always, the most important...
Steph? I would comment. I don't know if from the experience of everyone else in the room, if anybody else has been close to a sangha that really has been hurt by abusive behavior by their teacher. But I do have that experience. I've seen some students that I trained with and lived with get really hurt. I could say really confused, but that seems like putting it far too mildly. Really psychologically injured by abusive patterns of behavior from a teacher, a lineaged abbot. And I do think it helps at least some for other teachers who have a saner view of things to, as you said, go on the record and point out that this is not Buddhism, it has nothing to do with what the Buddha taught, and it's not right. And to me it almost seems silly to write that because it's so obvious, but obviously it still needs to be written, it still needs to be said, and for the people who are caught somewhere in the middle of a bad situation, maybe it does help to know that there's another perspective, to find out that there is a saner way of approaching this, and that it's not okay, and it doesn't make any sense to be packaging hurtful, selfish behavior in Buddhist language and saying it's somehow it's okay because whatever.
Thank you so much for saying that, Stefan. It is. It's so important. These aren't easy things to talk about. They're not easy things to face. But it's important. It really is a part of understanding the First Noble Truth, that dukkha occurs, and it even occurs in people that we trust. And that's just the way it is. And the way to be certain. is to develop the Buddhist path. Thank you for that, Stefan. Thank you all for your comments tonight. Moving forward, our retreat's coming up May 11th to 14th. I hope you all can join us on that. The schedule is going to change a little bit here. I am going to stop teaching in Clinton on Thursday nights. And I'm going to add Thursday night here, so 7:15, another night here in Frenchtown. I will continue with a lecture series on the first Wednesday of every month up in Clinton. And I think that's...
At the same place?
At the same place. Yeah. It'll be more just a series of introductory lectures, more than an ongoing class. I'll leave it at that. But I'm looking forward to, often when I'm driving up there on a Thursday night, I'm thinking, yeah, boy, it's nice. The great sangha developed up there. Really fun people, but I'd rather be here.
Mm-hmm. Will the Tuesday night and Thursday night be different from each other or the same?
Probably not much. I was thinking of maybe Thursday night would be in a beginner's class, but there's no reason for that. You know, when we have beginners here, you hear what I do. I give them a brief instruction. There's not a lot to begin this practice. It's more to as you go along and develop it. So I think it's just going to be another class like we have here. Maybe not as much teaching. I don't know, but we'll see. We'll see what happens. There's always impermanence. But anybody has any suggestions about a special type of class? Let me know. All right, let's finish with the with the Karaniya Metta Sutta. So, find your relaxed meditative posture. Gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body, and let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future, or that may have arisen from our talk tonight. And metta is both an aspiration for those of us developing the Eightfold Path and an ongoing expression of an awakened, fully mature human being. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Excuse me. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace.
Thank you for listening. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for guided meditations and instruction and Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos. We rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Please feel free to contact me through crossrivermeditation.com. Peace.